This is what I've been waiting for, and I hope our telephone connection holds up. I understand it's been a little problematic, but Robert Collins was career Air Force, serving in the fields of avionics, ground communications, engineering, physics, and intelligence, foreign technology division at Wright-Patt, gaining an in-depth understanding of all the career fields. After 22 years, he left public service to pursue the subject of UFOs full-time, living on an Air Force retirement supplemented by odd jobs. In his many adventures within the Air Force, he was tuned into the world of UFOs by Ernie Killerstrasse, I believe it is, in 1985. Ernie was a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who worked at the FTD, that would be Foreign Technology Division, until retiring. After performing some research, he concluded that the government UFO cover-up was real and went to great lengths to uncover the cover-up, which spanned over 60 years. So, in a moment, Robert Collins. First time on the air on Coast to Coast AM, Robert Collins, welcome.
How you doing, Art?
I'm doing very well indeed. Great to have you on the program, and I've been looking forward to this because I've heard so much about...
I hope it's not rumors and propaganda.
About Wright-Patt, and you seem to know quite a bit. What, Robert, got you involved in ufology, period?
What am I involved? No, just about everything, anything and everything from Area 51 to Los Alamos to...
No, not what you're involved in, but what got you involved. There's got to be a trigger event, something that got you started.
Well, let's see here. Okay, now I know where you're coming from. Well, it started back in, 1985, when I was sitting there as an analyst in the Foreign Technology Division in the field of theoretical physics and just chatting away with people there. And all of a sudden, the subject of UFOs came up. And one of those people in the office said, well, there's somebody you want to talk to. And so he gave me the name of one Ernie Killerstrasse. And, of course, by that time, Ernie was retired. And I called Ernie, and he gave me one walloping story, which I'll never forget to this day. And
But the initial conversation, I mean, did you initiate it? Did you sit across the table from somebody and say, you know, what do you know about UFOs?
Well, for some reason, when you're in a vault there, all the kinds of information fly around within the vault, and the subject of UFOs just came up. I don't know whether I brought it up or somebody else did. And then,
right.
And they said, well, there's, as I say, there's somebody you should talk to. And so there I got a hold of Ernie, and then he gave me some incredible stories, which I promptly wanted to check out with everybody else and verify that this guy was not a nutcase.
Can you do it quickly? I mean, can you give us an overview of what Ernie told you that set you on fire?
One incident was the F-106 incident at Misawa, Japan, back in 1959, where they had some specially modified 106s, specially equipped with new types of air-to-air radar, and they sent one of these things up to intercept a UFO that would normally come over. Normally the pattern would be they normally come over the base and sit there and hover. So on this particular day, they sent up one of these 106s to intercept it, and the pilot got within firing range, and he asked ground control if he had permission to fire, and ground control told him, well, we'll call the Pentagon and let's see if we can get the okay for you to do that. So the short story is that he got the okay and he fired his salvo of missiles at this UFO, and they all detonated, but the UFO was still there.
Yikes.
The pilot by that time was in a full panic. And he told ground control, it's still in the air. The missiles didn't have any effect on it. And by that time, according to the story, the tractor beam came out of the UFO and latched on the 106. And the ground controllers could hear the pilots screaming and yelling as this thing was being pulled into the UFO.
My God.
And the other little incident...
Let's stick with that one for just a moment. If you were to fire a salvo of missiles, whatever he had at the time, into a UFO, was it a disc typical disc
it's
shape?
Typical oval-looking shape, disc-shaped kind of object, right? And these things used to, back in the 50s, especially around Misawa, I understand that they used to just sit there and come in and just sit for hours and hours and just hover above the base.
My God. You know, that's kind of like taking a high-powered pistol and pumping six shots into somebody in front of you and having them smile at you.
Yeah.
You go, oh, oh.
Sure.
I mean, what, Robert, if you know, was the authorizing rationale to fire at something like this in the first place? Many of us have wondered about this. I mean, presumably something oval-shaped, defying gravity, having come light years to get here, probably wouldn't be something you want to shoot at, mostly.
Well, I don't know the mentality of the people who made that decision. I don't know how much they knew about what the Air Force knew starting from 1947 up to that period in 1959.
Right.
I don't know who the bureaucrats were in the Pentagon that said, yeah, go ahead and try it. Maybe they just want to see how their new weapon systems worked, would affect these UFOs.
Remember, UFOs are not a threat to national security.
Right. We know that, right?
So there was another incident, and then you tried to confirm these, and I'll be very interested in what you did. So what is the other one?
Well, according to what he said, there is a compound on Sandia Base that back in the early 60s that was used to do chemical testing on animals. And it's right across the street from where Loveless is today. If you go down to Sandia Base, if you get on the base, on the south end of the base, there's this called Loveless Institute, and they do testing on animals. You can hear the dogs barking in the back of the compound, so they test on dogs too. But back in '64, they were doing testing on horses and monkeys, and other exotic or different type. I don't remember all the different types of animals, but Ernie and his friend Bob was in this compound, and according to what he told me, they were doing chemical testing on alien body parts, radiation testing.
My God.
And those two stories, and then, of course, there's...
What, radiation testing?
Yeah, radiation to see how the body parts respond to radiation.
All right, so these were... Live apparent aliens dead?
These were very dead aliens.
Very dead.
They were. I guess, one of the doctors, I think, told Ernie they were. These bodies were on loan, or the body parts were on loan from Wright-Patterson at the time. And the doctor told Ernie the rest of what they had was up at Wright-Patt.
Holy smokes! All right, you're right. I mean, if somebody told you with a straight face these two stories, I can see how that would light a fire, get you going, try to confirm the stories. After all, if true, this is the world's biggest story, isn't it?
Oh, it's been a big story for a long time, but it seems to get buried in the wars of Iraq or something.
Well, yeah. So all right, you heard this. You set out to try and confirm the stories. What did you do?
Well, it was a succession of steps. First, I had a call, a lot of people, and I who knew Ernie, and verified that this guy was really who he said he was. And they said, "Yes, we've heard the same stories, and we know who he is. We know his background, and we don't doubt what he's saying to us that it might be true." Then I proceeded to call Bill Moore, and
of course, Bill Moore,
right? And Bill Moore took a very big interest in this, in Ernie. And so he called Ernie, I believe, and I don't know what he talked to.
Would you do me a favor and repeat Ernie's last name again?
Kellerstrass.
Kellerstrass. Okay. What position was he in? What was Ernie? How did he know all these things?
Well, that's another story in itself. He is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. He's worked at AFLTEC. His primary mission was in intelligence. He did a lot of intelligence work, but he tells me that he never had any direct access to any of this material. It's what somebody else told him, except for the two direct incidences that we talked about.
Okay, and these two, though, in 1959 and I believe 1964,
Right.
He has direct...
Were the two that he said he was directly involved in. But he said he doesn't know anything above that beyond what he was told. However, there was a Paul McGovern who knows Ernie, who's a good friend of Ernie's, who said Ernie was out at Area 51.
Is Ernie still with us?
Oh, yes. Well, and he still works here in Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, Ohio. All right.
Right.
Do you correspond with him frequently?
I haven't talked to him in a couple years. These sources are very strange people, and they will tend to tell you a lot of things, and then they'll just sit there and pull back on you.
So that would imply that you've gone to Ernie at another point and he denied it or denied ever saying it or what?
He said he was having too many family problems and he just didn't want to, get into any more conversations about it.
Understandable, Robert. A number of people that I've interviewed over the years, including John Lear, has had a number of periods in his career when he just said, look, I'm washing my hands of this. I've had it. I'm not going to talk about this stuff anymore. It is affecting my family, my career. I just can't do it anymore. That kind of deal.
Sure. Right.
So, anyway, you have independently confirmed in these two incidences and maybe more what Ernie told you.
I'm trying to quantify that. The only thing we can confirm is that the fact that they had the 106s at the time. That's the only thing that we can confirm. We can't confirm the incident because the Air Force denies it. You can't confirm the incident on the south area of Sandia Base back in 1964 because, and again, that gets denied. The only things we can confirm are what sources tell us is what's the makeup of Wright-Patterson and the tunnels and the bolts.
Well, we'll get to that. On the F-106, you would think that it would be possible to confirm the loss of a pilot, whether it would be listed as an accident or some other way.
In that case, it would just be listed as an accident, lost at sea or something, and presumed dead.
Right. Okay. So you were in contact then with Bill Moore and Jamie?
Bill Moore, I met in the spring of 1986 in a motel room in Los Angeles. Was on TDY to TRW at the time there.
Right.
And he showed me a copy of, before it was ever in the public domain, of the Eisenhower briefing document, that 35-millimeter film.
Sure.
The famous one.
Oh, yes.
And he just showed it to me, and he said, do you know anything about this? And I just looked at the document, and I said, this is news to me. And... he said he couldn't let me have copies of it, and so that's how everything got started. And I went back to Dayton, Ohio, and he went back to wherever he was doing, and then the phone calls, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of hours of phone calls, and then we had the meetings all the way from starting in the fall of 1986, and that's when I met Jamie at Ernie's house. Ernie Kellerstrass house, and we had Hal Putoff and John Alexander and a number of other people there, and we had a big powwow about this, and Ernie then explained everything he knew about the subject to us in the living room.
And can you relate?
That's what got all the ball rolling on everything.
Yeah, can you relate some of that? Can you remember the high points?
Well, he went into details about Area 51 and the guards disappearing in Area 51. All they could find was the vehicle, and we talked a little bit about or mentioned the Red Book, and then we talked about the Yellow Book. And the fact is that the aliens believe in one God, and that the Red Book is a compilation of all the ongoing government research since 1947.
Let me slow you down again. The Red Book, you said, and the aliens believe in one God.
Are you familiar with the Majestic website?
I am.
Okay. If you go to the Majestic website, there's something called the First Annual Report. You ever seen it?
I believe I have. Yes.
Okay. Well, the Red Book is those annual reports were put out every year starting in around 1952. And so the 52, 53, 54, they took all those annual reports and put them together into one volume called the Red Book.
Okay.
So each year the Red Book gets updated with a new annual report.
All right. Let's go to direct knowledge that you have. You were at Wright Pat. You know something about, and I've really always been curious about these underground vaults, these hangars, all these underground things that are said to be under Wright Patterson, and what's hidden there. How much do you actually know about that, Robert?
Well, let me try to put it this way. We have enough information that if we had an interested party like Congress willing to investigate that, we could prove that those things are there in a matter of days.
How would you do that?
All we'd have to do is knock down some concrete walls.
Knock down some concrete walls in a heavily protected...
It would take civil engineering a couple of days to knock down those walls to prove that those tunnels and those vaults are there.
How do you know they're there?
Oh, because they've been seen on radar. I don't work by myself. I work with a group of people. And I have a lot of people in important places like at Wright Pat who have access to things. And they tell me certain things. And also, too, I've got thousands and thousands of drawings taken from Wright Pat that are official. In fact, it's the guy who gave them to me had a security clearance pulled.
Really?
Yes, he lost his security clearance over it. And these drawings, plus what's been seen on radar imaging, which I didn't get to see, but my friend did, who works there.
You have these drawings now, Robert?
They're on the machine here. And they're also in the book. You've got a lot of the drawings are in that book you have. I don't know if you have a copy of it.
No, I do not in front of me.
Okay. I sent one to Lisa, I believe. Lisa has a copy.
Right. It just didn't make it to me in time. That's all right. We're on radio anyway, so what we've got to try to do is describe, you know, if somebody lost their security clearance over this, and you've got it in a book, then it's public knowledge, right?
At this point. If we were given permission, we could prove the case there in a couple days. That's how confident we are.
Well, you and I both know that is not going to happen.
No, the Air Force is not going to allow you to bust down their walls.
No. Nope. So how much is below Wright Pat? I mean, physically, how much is down there?
Physically, there are about, if I'm trying to count these right, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 vaults.
5 what you call vaults?
Well, anywhere from a size of 100 by 100 feet, which is 1,000 square feet, all the way up to, or I should say all the way down to some little small vault area, which is down by the what we call the med, used to be the medical center, or the biological medical study center, which is down the hill from where the main vaults are at, and that's where I understand that's where they brought a. They used to roll these tunnels, or you could drive a pickup truck through.
And they probably do.
Yeah, they're big tunnels, and you could drive a Ford pickup truck through them.
And how much do we know about what's stored in these vaults?
Well, there's nothing stored there anymore. All this was, they move faster. They keep track of the public attitudes and public ideas and what the public might know about this stuff. And as soon as they think they're in trouble, they take all the stuff and they move it. So all this stuff was moved out of Wright Pat in 82 and 83.
To where?
Primarily to Los Alamos and to Area 51.
Okay, well, there are others who say that there was a great deal at Area 51 and that it was moved out of there.
I can't verify any of that. I can't verify those kind of stories. And Rick Doty, I talked to Rick, and I've got other sources, and I can't verify any of those stories.
So your best intel at the moment would be that a lot of this is still at Area 51?
Right. Yeah, they're making some big major money investments in Area 51, so I really doubt that anything's been moved.
Well, you're right about that. They're expanding Area 51. All right, Robert, hold tight. Robert Collins is my guest. He says a lot of what was at Wright Pat was moved to Area 51 and elsewhere, and to the best of his knowledge, it's still there. And that would have been my bet, because indeed they're expanding Area 51. you can't get as close as you used to. I'm Art Bell. Robert Collins is my guest. He says he knows a lot about what was apparently at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, part of what still may be there, the underground areas that were associated with the storage of you-know-what. We'll get back to him in a moment. Well, all right, Robert Collins has a website, www.ufoconspiracy.com, good domain name, and his book is Exempt from Disclosure. Robert, why exempt from disclosure?
Well, it's a typical label they put on documents they don't want to downgrade. So they'll put at the bottom either exempt from exempt. Well, actually, it'll say exempt from downgrade.
Meaning downgrade in security level.
Yeah, security level, right? Exempt from downgrade. Right. It'll say that down the lower right corner, I believe. It's been a while since I looked at some of those documents. So that the so in a sense, what it's saying, it's exempt from disclosure.
Okay. All right. This person, how did it come about that you got these diagrams of what is below Wright Pat?
Well, it goes back to the. The civil, what I call my civil engineering person, without mentioning names.
Right.
He and I started working together about 1993. It was over a 10-year effort on our parts. And then we took information from the sources, like Ernie provided a lot of information, and Rick Doty provided a lot of information. And we took their information plus what we got out of the drawings. And we were able to fit all that source information with what was in the drawings,
right.
And so we could match up with what they're saying with what we found. And
was he still active duty?
We had to go through thousands and thousands—I mean, literally thousands and thousands—of Wright Pat drawings.
Uh-huh. Was he still active duty when he handed you these?
Oh, he's civil service.
Civil service,
right.
But still employed.
Right. Yeah, he had a huge interest in it and finding out whether those bolts were really there or not. And so he did a lot of his own investigation, plus we were working together, and he gave me a lot of those drawings, which I ran copies of them, scanned them in, and then destroyed the original copies so he wouldn't get in trouble.
But he did get in trouble. He got his clearance yanked, right?
Yeah, in 1998, he got his clearance pulled.
As a direct result of what he gave you?
Right. As soon as the let me back up on that. As of 1996, he had his clearance pulled.
Okay.
It's because of when I first posted a preliminary report on the vaults at Wright-Patterson, the Air Force just went ballistic.
Were you contacted?
No, but they had my phones tapped.
Nobody has
physically ever come to see me.
Okay, how do you know your phones were tapped? A good tap is not detectable.
My good friends like Rick Doty have the abilities and the equipment to test phone lines that can detect rust 2,000 miles away.
Okay, so you believe your phones were tapped, or they confirmed it for you.
Right.
And you did say you had thousands of hours of conversations on the phone, right?
Right. Well, with all the people I mentioned to you before, right, we had nonstop Jamie, Bill, we had Kit Green, Hal Putoff. Of course, John Alexander was out there somewhere on the left. He was never really that involved in it. And plus the people I just talked to you, my
I know John Alexander very well.
Yeah, that's why my Wright Pat person. And then we had not only thousands of hours of conversations, but we had these regular meetings up to about 1991, I believe.
Huh. Okay. What Air Force office does counter-intel work?
That would be Rick's old office, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, PJ. We call them the pajama gang affectionately.
Uh-huh.
And they're the ones that run all the counterintelligence. They protect all the black programs for the Air Force. They have an office right here at Wright-Patterson. They have an office there in the Pentagon, and I think they might have an office at Kirtland, or they may maybe they used to, but I don't know if they still do.
Where are you actually located right now?
I'm in Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio. Oh, so you're close.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yeah.
Close to Nevada.
Do you think your phones are still tapped?
As of 2003, there were still phone taps on this phone line as of 2003. So we just assume they're phone taps on.
Mm-hmm. All right. When they yanked his clearance, they must have, pulled him in, and he had to stand in front of somebody, and something happened, right?
Yes, but I didn't get those details. I know when I posted that preliminary Wright-Patt report back in 96, they sent him to Florida on a vacation for 2 weeks.
Uh-huh. Okay. What...
He doesn't tell me everything, but I learn enough things that you can get a good picture of what's going on.
Uh-huh. The Aeronautical Systems Center (ASC) at Wright-Patt does what? They oversee, as you mentioned, the black programs, right?
Well, you've heard of Aurora, haven't you?
Of course.
Well, they manage the Aurora program out at Area 51.
Okay.
They manage the F-117 and the B-2 when it was hush-hush and in a black program.
All those now are pretty well known.
Right.
One can only imagine, or perhaps you can tell us, Robert, what came after Aurora, what came after the B-2. In other words, those were the secret projects being managed. What are they managing now?
I don't know what if they have anything after the B-2. I don't know if they have anything after the 117. We suspect, but we can't really prove at this point that the that they manage UFO programs.
You know anything about black triangles?
Yes. Uh huh. No. Are they? Are yeah. I know some people say they're ours, but I don't believe that.
Okay. Where exactly at Los Alamos are the UFO artifacts?
Well, TA 49 is the was the original facility. That was called the Dulce Complex in 1954. They converted an underground nuclear storage facility into what has now become the Dulce Complex.
Right.
And then there's a few other locations, but we don't know a whole lot about them. And one of them is in what's TA? I can't remember that one. Was TA 40? But yeah, it was TA 40. TA 40 is now the alternate entryway into TA 49. Because in TA 49, they closed up that entryway back in around 2001 because of all the security leaks.
What was there that you know of?
You mean in TA 49?
Yes.
I have never been in that facility, but Rick has, and I understand.
What does Rick say?
Well, it's pretty huge. And there was they always use front organizations to hide. What they're really trying to do in some places, and that's normally designated as a munitions testing area. But then in a certain building you'd walk into, and you'd go to a certain elevator, and this elevator was behind a vault door, and they'd have to open the vault door up before you could go in the elevator. And this elevator would get down about five stories or so, and it would open up on the bottom. And he said the underground facility there, which we call the Dulce Complex, was pretty extensive.
And what did he see?
He said he just saw, went into a room and escorted into a room and sat down in the back with a friend and a lieutenant colonel or a Fulbert colonel. I'm sorry, a Fulbert colonel walked up to him and had him sign a special security clearance for the EB-2 interview.
For the EB2 interview.
Right, which is in the book.
Extraterrestrial biological entity, right?
Right.
Continue.
As it's described in the book...
describe it here.
He said that, I'm trying to remember all the details of that. 4 foot, was it 4 foot three alien walked in and a tight-fitting jumpsuit, and there were three civilians there at the front table. I think there was a colonel. I think there was a colonel and two civilians right there, sitting right there at the interview table. And he wasn't sure whether this EBE was either talking verbally or telepathically. He couldn't tell where the sound was coming from, but he could hear it, but he couldn't see the mouth of the EBE moving.
Okay. You believe him?
I do, because everything else he's told me, it checks out. Right Pat sure checked out.
Well, when you say Right Pat checked out, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean that the documents that you got this guy's clearance pulled checked out, or
the documents show you where walls were put up, where stairwells were at, where elevators were at, where tunnel entries were at, where surveillance cameras were at, and then there's nothing there.
I mean, all of this could be true, Robert, but it could be for a national security purpose that either did or didn't have anything to do with ETs or ET artifacts or whatever.
Well, they certainly pulled this guy's clearance for some reason, I guess.
Well, anytime you disclose something that's national security, trust me, your security clearance is going to vaporize.
Well, we must have hit something, but...
I'm sure you did.
It certainly was pretty extensive, and the way this thing was blocked, and these entryways were blocked and concreted up, and walls were put up, and that the people there would never know there was anything there. People today there work at Right Pat have no idea where any of this stuff would be.
Well, apparently... this stuff is no longer there. Are you fairly sure of that, that it's all been cleared out?
You can never be 100% clear, certain of anything, but we're pretty certain that all the hardware and was moved out. There might be some documentation, which still is kept at NASIC, which used to be FTD, but we don't know that. We can't prove those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you have first-hand knowledge of any of the things that we've talked about so far tonight? Because most of what you've told me has been, you know, so-and-so told me, so-and-so told me.
I've seen UFOs a number of times.
Okay. But, I mean, with respect to what you've told us about Dulce, about Right Pat, and we've sort of briefly touched on Area 51, we'll talk about S4.
Well, I'm not so much of a person who goes out to who has seen things. What I do is collect information and put it together. We call it intelligence in the Air Force.
Sure.
And so I take all the source information plus the things I learn on my own and put it together. Try to check it, which we've done, be able to do with other sources, with other facilities, and with other people. And put it together and put out a report.
And so the conclusions you've come to are that they had these underground facilities that you've documented. You've got the drawings of them at Right Pat. They had, you believe, artifacts there, possibly bodies there. They were moved, you believe, to Dulce or Area 51. Is that correct?
That's correct, as far as we know.
How much do you know now? Robert, I'm right out here. You may be near Right Pat, but I'm just around the corner from Area 51, just over the mountain from me here. And I'd be very interested in how much you know about Area 51, how compartmentalized the whole thing is.
All I know about Area 51 is what the sources report, what's in the book, what Kit Green has told me. Kit Green said he was out there, but he never saw any UFOs. Gene Legs was the chief of security there up to 1996, and he knows Kit Green. Kit didn't have the access to go to the places that this stuff was kept. And even if you work at Area 51, you're extremely compartmentalized. They wear color-coded badges, and they're separated by cantonment areas. So unless you have the access, you won't see anything that's out of the unusual.
Mm-hmm. Then how do you know anything out of the unusual is there?
Other than what the what's on the people videotaped, these objects around Area 51, or what the sources have said, that's as much as I know.
And S4?
And S4 is the same way. The sources have said they've been there, described it, said this is what's there, and said some of what Lazar's saying is true.
Have you spoken to Bob Lazar?
No, I've had, but friends of mine have. I haven't spoken to him. Rick Doty's the drawings in the book of the S4 facility, which are in the book, Rick Doty says that's exactly the way it's laid out.
Mm-hmm. All right. You claim to know, apparently, from one of the questions here, how the anti-gravity systems work on reverse-engineered UFOs, which you believe, I guess, were flying, right?
Again, back to what the sources say, they've been flying these since what, the early 60s. And according to what the sources say, they've crashed a lot in the Gulf of Mexico. The Cash Landrum case was an example of that, where in that case that object over Texas got in trouble and is surrounded by helicopters. And, of course,
Barney Hill.
Yeah, got severely burned by the radiation from that thing. That was supposedly one of our reverse-engineered our objects or craft.
Okay, so you actually know, though, how the anti-gravity systems work?
Well, this goes back to the latest in what's going on in the world of physics, and then what the sources are telling me, and I compare what the sources are telling me with what's going on in physics. And right now, they're saying that superconducting capacitors are superconducting currents.
Right.
And the superconducting currents are used for deep space, and superconducting capacitor configurations are used for the atmospheres of planets.
Okay. To maneuver in atmosphere.
You have to reconfigure the anti-gravity field to maneuver in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Even though the alien energy device, ED, whatever that is way beyond our ability to understand, can you explain its basic operation?
It's a device of what contains what? So around 6,366 small black circular objects, whether they want 0.003 centimeters, and spinning counterclockwise. Within a circular sphere, and this sphere supposedly has liquid in it, and when they put a demand of electricity on this device, they get an output, and this liquid collects around these little circular black devices is an isotope of hydrogen called H5, and this H5 it acts as a catalyst to extract energy out of the vacuum. I'm doing a lot of work at Los Alamos, from what I understand, to try to get produce H5 and then find ways to stabilize it. Because it's very unstable. And they do have some patented devices. Some of those are in the book, I'm not sure how much success they've had with them.
All right. Robert, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. We've got to take a break. I wonder if H5 has anything to do with element 115 or if they're related. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back. Robert Collins is my guest. The advertisement for this show was a lot of information about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, then Area 51, S4, Dulce, and so forth, Los Alamos. We'll continue with that, and we were on the subject of H5, and I was wondering if it had any relationship to 115, also considered to be somewhat unstable. Back to Robert Collins in a moment. All right, Robert, let's finish up with H5. I started thinking, H5, element 115. I wonder if there's some relationship.
Not that I could find. As far as the 115, all the information or sources I've ever talked to never confirmed that kind of story. You know, the place I've heard that from is Bob Lazar and in some science journals, and that's about it.
Well, John Lear as well.
They discovered or something. They discovered 115, but it doesn't fit in with anything that I've learned or know in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, H5.
Again, H5, it was created, but it's extremely unstable. And it's being used, or they're trying to use it as a catalyst, which will extract energy out of the vacuum, which is something that Hal Puthoff has been looking for a long time. And again, Los Alamos is trying to find ways to stabilize it, from what I understand. And they've got a couple patented devices to do that. Again, that's covered in the book. And that's about as much as I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with the frontiers of physics and this kind of stuff, just like you're dealing with superconductors, rotating superconductors and anti-gravity and configuring propulsion systems. And even the people at Los Alamos are having a heck of a time with the alien craft, according to what they're telling me.
Can you tell us who they would be?
They don't give me their proper names. They give me first names, which you find out later on are not real, and you get sent information, but they're not going to ever tell you who they are. They could,
so there's no way for you to really confirm this stuff.
No, of course not. They could. It's like a rock in a hard place. They could get in very serious trouble if they ever got caught doing it.
Uh-huh. Is there anything that we should be covering, really big revelations that we should cover that we haven't covered in the program so far?
Other than we covered the color-coded badging and the compartmentalization at Area 51,
mm-hmm.
Cantonments, there's Dulles, Angleton, and Helms. And the Doty family, Angleton, and his job is in CIA as a deputy director of counterintelligence, and his association with Dulles and Helms, and always kind of a knock on the door where he could just walk in at any time and advise these two directors of anything in the intelligence world, anything that was going on. And he had an enormous power until he got fired by Kobe in 1974.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the subject material of any of those advisories?
We know that Angleton kept track of a great deal of number of UFO reports, and again, that's covered in the book.
Uh-huh.
And that he fed these reports to the director and I know from other sources that I've talked to who, in fact, is Rick's father, Charles Doty, knew Angleton. Another source, Edmondson, last name Edmondson, knew Angleton. But Angleton was in charge of protecting MJ-12 as far as the CIA was concerned. Because before MJ-12 got moved, and it was at CIA before it got moved. Angleton was responsible for doing that. And eventually back in 1986, they moved the responsibility for MJ-12 to NSA.
I
believe it's in a section called Group C at NSA.
Okay, maybe you have an answer for this, Robert. But if we had all of this reverse-engineered technology, some of it, no doubt, applicable to weaponry, we'd be using it to protect our young men and women in Iraq. And if we're not, why not?
Because what the sources or the scientists at Los Alamos tell me, you know, and they tell me indirectly, of course, because to protect themselves, is that the materials, they're having a real tough time with the materials on the craft because the materials are not we can't make any material on this planet that would match anything on these craft. And the second problem is they can't properly configure the propulsion system so that the craft are stable. In other words, the ones that we make, we have ones that do fly. They call them ARVs. They repeatedly have stability problems with them and they crash. I've been having those problems for over roughly since 1956 up to the present, where everything they've tried didn't succeed. And what I was told is that we had to go back to the drawing board and learn the alien physics, and that's what the sources are telling me.
Is there anything about the alien physics that can be differentiated and explained from what we understand as our world's physics?
Well, it's just like looking at that crystal rectangle, and what I briefly described there with the crystal rectangle, our scientists don't understand that. That's covered in the documents in the book. And so what they do with these kind of things is they go as far with them as they can. They test them. This crystal rectangle was flown on shuttle missions and brought to the space station before the Columbia disaster. And we don't know if the Columbia had one of these crystal rectangles, because there's more than one. There's a couple of them. And they use them to, obviously they, from the testing they've done, they give tremendous power output, and it can, there's no power limit as to what, as far as the demand is concerned.
Crystal rectangles. I didn't know a thing about them.
That's your alien energy device.
Okay, that is the energy device.
The code name one is called the crystal rectangle.
Mm-hmm. And where does this information come from?
This comes out of there's DIA documents which are in the book there. That information is right out of those documents, plus the information I've gotten from my sources over the years, long before I ever got those documents.
Defense Intelligence Agency, right?
Right.
And you're certain of the authenticity of the documents?
Well, I'm not certain of anything. I don't know if the documents are really, mm-hmm. really authentic. But the FBI did make a visit to Gig Green about me.
All right. Gig Green, who's that?
He's up at Wayne State University. He's, again, he's covered in the book. He's a good friend of Hal Putoff's.
And the FBI went to him about you?
Right. He tells me that they wanted the FBI wanted him to spy on me. So he wasn't willing to do that, so he told me about it.
And what exactly did they want him
because
to...
Because of these documents that are in the book, and Rick Doty's warned me a couple of times about the FBI coming to visit me, and they have never come, even though I've doors open and they can come any time.
Uh-huh. Were you the only author of this book, or did you have a co-author, Robert?
Oh, they're contributors. Rick Doty was willing to be a contributor, and Timothy Cooper is a contributor as well.
Timothy Cooper.
Right. He's out Big Bear there in California, and he's the son his father was in the Air Force, and he's the... Timothy was in the Marines for about 4 years, and he got out, and he just does odd jobs there at Big Bear. I think he might have, I'm not too sure of this, his mother has a disability, or believe her, she's getting old or something. I haven't talked to Tim in 3 or 4 months, so I really don't know all the details of what he's doing right now.
When did your book come out?
The first edition came out in April 2005, and the second edition came out in May of 2006.
I see. And how's it been greeted?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. There's been a lot of hostility resentment and name calling, and then a lot of people have just thought it was great, was really great, and they loved it.
Okay. Well, I can't comment on the book, but most of what you've had to say, by your own admission, is in fact, none of it really is first-hand information, but rather collected information from other sources.
Right. It's all most of it is collected information from other sources, and except for the stuff that was done at RIPAT.
In other words, the documents you were handed.
The documents were.
Is that what you're referring to?
The drawings? No,
yes.
The drawings in the book are official drawings from RIPAT.
Okay.
They are official Air Force drawings.
All right, and you're really certain of that?
Yeah, because I have the drawings here with the labels on, with the Air Force labels on them.
But you did destroy the originals.
I did destroy the originals, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, if all this is true, it is surprising that you have not yet received a visit by the FBI or worse.
Well, there's something here that if you pay attention to something that you know might be real, if they were to pay attention to me, that would just draw the attention of everybody else.
Well, there's some truth in that. All right. Well, listen, Robert, I want to thank you for being on the program. I'd like to invite people to take a look at your book, Exempt from Disclosure, or your website, UFOconspiracy.com, right?
Right.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the program, and you have a good night.
All right. Thank you, Art.
Take care, Robert. Okay. That is Robert Collins, and you can take that as you will, folks. Most of the information, I was hoping that it was going to be first person, you know, I saw, I handled, I was part of, that kind of thing. But most of it was second or third hand information, with the exception, as he pointed out, of the documents, which describe the underground areas, apparently, below Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and certainly that has worth. What I'm going to do is open the phone lines, and we're going to go to open lines. We pretty well exhausted the material that Robert had, in my opinion.